Welcome to the Dialogue by Wirepoints, connecting the dots between our economy, government, and people. And now your hosts, Ted Dabrowski and Mark Glennon.
Mark Glennon from Wirepoints here with my colleague, Ted Dabrowski, the president of Wirepoints. And we have a very special guest today. Kristen McQuarrie has a very unique insight into journalism and local press. She's seen it all. She started as a local reporter, and her most recent position was as editor of the editorial page at the Chicago Tribune, where she quit back in June. We're going to talk mostly about the future of journalism, all the challenges facing both local and national journalism, as well as anything else that comes to mind that Kristen wants to throw in. Kristen, as I said, your most recent position was editor to the editorial page. We were big fans of your particular columns, but tell us what you're up to since you left. I know you had a couple months off to spend some little more time with your son and daughter, but you got a new gig. What you up to now?
I did. I left the trip. I think my last day was around 4th of July. And then I took a couple months to figure out what I wanted to do next. And I'm very happy with my new job. I work for a consulting firm called Res Publica Group. It's downtown. We do a lot of kind of behind the scenes consulting and public relations work, communications work. They have a great creative staff that does some more, like if you want to launch a campaign, not a political campaign, we don't do that, but different campaigns, and doing a lot of similar things to being a reporter, research, writing, editing, but just doing it for clients instead of readers.
And in journalism, you really did start at the bottom and end at the top. I seem to recall you writing that, you know, as a beat reporter, when you first started out, you had like the tough assignments of knocking on the doors of parents, victims of crime and things like that. And you eventually were on the editorial board at the Chicago Tribune. We particularly enjoyed your individual columns, which you published separately sometimes. But tell us a little bit more about how your career evolved, how that came to be.
I did start at the bottom. I realized I wanted to be a reporter pretty early on in my college years. I went to Illinois State University. So when people talk about, you know, like when I was in journalism school, well, I didn't go to journalism school. I went to Illinois State. I got a job at the student newspaper. And my first job was actually as a copy editor on the night desk at the Pantograph. So I would go to school during the day and then work the night shift from 5 p.m. to 1 a.m. Editing and writing obituaries. So that's kind of low on the totem pole, obviously, in a newsroom. But important work, really important work. I have an affinity still to this day for obituaries and obituary writers. And I worked at a few Central Illinois newspapers, covering the night cops beat and covering government, and then moved up to the Chicago area. My first job up here was at the Daily Southtown, where I started covering Springfield. And I did that for a number of years. Then I worked in radio a little bit, and then got a job at the Chicago Tribune editorial board and loved it. So I switched over to opinion writing, and then was only the second woman in the newspaper's history to be editorial page editor until I left. So it was maybe a year and a half of editorial page editor, and it was right when COVID hit. So I don't really feel I got the full experience of it, but I did the best that I could, you know, under those circumstances.
Well, we're going to talk about the challenges and all of that. And it's not a bit of an understatement to say that this is a crisis that threatens democracy at all levels. Democracy does not function unless you have informed voters. And, you know, it starts at the bottom with the struggles that local media are having with the financial model that's lacking. Local papers are disappearing, and it goes all the way up to the top, where the problem is primarily bias. I think in the national media, it's far worse than in state media, but The biggest players are the worst, in my opinion. New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, Associated Press, and others. But let's go through some of it. Ted, I'll turn it over to you for a few questions to start out with.
Well, yeah, I think probably need a little bit of a background because, you know, there's so much chaos in the media right now. And, you know, interestingly enough, WirePoints exists because we felt that that the media wasn't doing a good job of telling the truth about the state's finances. And that's how, you know, when Mark founded this, that's how he got started. And of course, that was my motivation in partnering with Mark too, because there's just so much data that fails to come out of the newspapers. And if it does come out, it comes out in a funny way, right? Or it's not told in a truthful way or whatever. It's in some form, it's not right. So I think maybe if you can define for all of us who are trying to think about this, what is the problem with media these days? You know, how does it start? I was listening to, let me just, as a little bit of background, I was listening to a radio show and I heard a person talking about media and saying how in the old days, the people who were in media were like you, Kristen, who worked up the chain and weren't necessarily from some Ivy League school and studied journalism and other things. Whereas today I understand it's mostly made up of people who are more elite. And you know, gone are the days of the Kristen McQueries. Is that true? And is that kind of how we got to this mess we're in?
I mean, there's so many facets to what media is today. I think there's still so I've only ever really seen the newspaper side, but there are still reporters, you know, grinding it out, going to crime scenes in the middle of the night, not making very good wages at all, living in tiny little apartments. I mean, that's what I have seen at every newspaper I've been at. You know, I used to get in arguments with one of my friends about liberal bias, because as a news reporter, I always tried to be just very careful about, you know, not only giving both sides, but trying to choose the best arguments for both sides. You know, sitting in the Illinois House or Senate and listening to a debate, and not just running and getting the easy quote, but, you know, trying to provide context and be respectful of both sides and really keep myself out of it. And I just see more and more that journalism has become more advocacy. And so I can't really make that argument anymore to my friend that there isn't liberal bias. I mean, it's hard to make that argument when conservative voices are just, that, you know, they're kind of squelched. They're not respected in many instances. And even on the editorial page, you know, the Tribune had a long history of being a conservative-leaning, libertarian-leaning newspaper. Our motto was personal responsibility and free markets. And the pushback from the newsroom grew more intense right up until the time that I decided to leave. So, I think it is the advocacy part is a problem. And I think it's also been made worse by social media and access that reporters have directly to readers, where there isn't enough restraint, I don't think, in newsrooms on keeping reporters from tweeting their personal opinions. And then they turn around and cover something. And so it just kind of lays bare for people who are paying attention what these reporters' personal politics are. And when you're covering politics, it's not a good look. And I think it's been hard for the industry to maintain credibility when you don't have editors kind of pulling back on reporters who feel it necessary to, you know, put their personal views out there. It's just not something, again, I didn't go to journalism school, but some of my earliest editors, we never, you know, they were careful about the length of a story and making sure that both sides or multiple sides got the same amount of space, that if there was a jump to the inside section, you got both sides before the jump. There were measurements of, you know, how many lines was this person quoted and how many lines was this person quoted, to be sure that you had sort of some fairness checks. And I feel like a lot of that has just kind of gone out the window. And I don't know that it's going to head back, you know, into a different direction.
And you said there are many facets to this, and you do have to take it at each different level, because it seems to me they apply differently. I, I think the worst bias is at the top, at the national media. Yeah, we complain about it, and for local media here too, sometimes with some reporters, although I feel a lot of sympathy for them. As you said, they're grossly underpaid. It's a tough job, and they've got this broken financial model. But do you agree with that? That the you know, at the national level, they many top journalists overtly say that they're not about a reporting objectively. They're trying to spin a narrative, and that's even taught in some of the top journalism schools. So there's a professor at Northwestern who openly advocates that. The dean of Columbia's venerated journalism school has said that, and there are others. It's not that bad in Illinois, though, is it? Or what do you think?
I mean, I agree with you. The national media is just, it's just become like a total circus. I mean, I can remember when CNN actually had really in-depth packaged overseas reporting. They went to, like many of them, this cheaper model of just two people shouting at each other on a screen. And I think there's a real lack of education among audiences that they don't even really realize that they're watching shows that have bias built into them by design. I can remember it was probably around the time Trump was elected. Family members of mine, not fans at all, but didn't, you know, they were getting all their news from MSNBC. these are my parents, okay? And I had to like educate them. Like, okay, that's fine. I realize you don't like President Trump and he drives you nuts, but you are watching a station that was created to give the Democratic spin, to be a left of center perspective. And just like Fox is right of center, you're watching the other product. And then of course, I mean, CNN is really no different, but my parents were kind of, I don't think they realized that. And they're smart, educated newspaper reading people. So the national media is just, they're just completely agenda driven. And to be frank, I mean, I don't really watch those cable shows. I just don't. I think they tend to just inflame, you know, more than inform.
Well, Kristen, does that mean that this form of news, you know, the game's over now? It's more either entertainment or, you know, whatever you want to call it. You can watch your favorite political channel because it's on your side, and that's fine, right? That's a product, but it's no longer media. It's no, well, I guess it's all, we're coming back to definitions again, but yeah, Fox can be Fox and CNBC or MSNBC can be there, you know, what they do. But does that mean that the traditional news and consumption of news, the way maybe we did with, you know, the whatever Walter Cronkite or whomever, is that game over because it's now going to show up in some other on internet somewhere?
I mean, the pendulums always swing and overcorrect, right? So I'm hoping that the pendulum right now has swung too far in one direction, and the profitability of these networks will be based on drawing people back like me. So I don't think it's a lost cause. But, you know, locally, you still have outlets kind of stepping in, like Wire Points. You have the Better Government Association doing, you know, really good, strong investigative journalism. You have ProPublica. You have some of these other groups that have stepped in. And for the consumer who wants good, hard-hitting news, you can find it. You just can't really find it by turning on your television.
One aspect of the infection of the national media into the local media that drives me crazy, Kristen, is to the extent they're able to cover national stories at all, it's really just a syndicated story that comes from, you know, typically the Associated Press. They get blasted out across the state and almost everywhere. The Tribune is guilty of this too. It's always either the Associated Press or New York Times. And on those big national stories, they are very biased. You know, Associated Press is okay on kind of the local nuts and bolts stories, which they do sometimes. But are there any alternatives there? I mean, who, if they were wanted to correct this, could they turn to Reuters, I guess, you know, has a syndicated product. I don't know if they're cost effective, if that's something that could be afforded by these struggling local papers. But how could they correct that?
I mean, to me, the correction comes in, eating in at probably the profitability of some of these organizations. I can tell you, I got complaints almost every day when I was editorial page editor about the Tribune picking up more and more wire service and running more and more New York Times content. Even the promotions people in the newsroom had a tendency to, you know, like promote something that was a New York Times story that we were running even more than some local content. I think the biggest problem is just the loss of human beings doing a lot of this work. So to me, fixing the problem requires hiring more people. And I'll just point to the Daily Southtown, which was in the same building for a long time as a newspaper called the Star. So the Star and the Southtown were these hyper local newspapers. I mean, we had human beings in every town from Harvey to Lansing to Orland Park to Mokena. We were in school board meetings. It was really important, you know, to have someone there to keep those governing bodies more accountable. And as circulation dropped and ad revenue dropped and they started, you know, we were taken over by another company. I mean, that newspaper just almost evaporated. There's just a handful of people who are actually Southtown reporters. The Trib owns it now, but just that model has happened everywhere. I mean, look at the State House press room and how few bodies there are covering government. Your newspapers are going to have to continually rely on national wire services if they're not going to put human beings in those bureaus.
Yeah, that's one of the big challenges we've seen, and maybe it's been our opportunity at WirePoints. You know, there is no viable local press all over the place that can report on many things. And when we do talk to a few of them, they say they're covering everything. Like if they have a body, as you say, they've got a camera. They're the camera person and the writer, and have to do all the work. And so, even if they are good, and even if they are dedicated, there's no way that they can open up a financial document on the city and look at the, you know, whatever the pension crisis or the property tax problems. And it's asking a lot. So in a way, that's our opportunity to kind of provide a lot of that data as WirePoints, where we slice the numbers and share it with different localities. But even then, they have a hard time picking it up and messaging it correctly, because it is complex stuff. And if you're not spending a lot of time on it, it's tough. So what is, you know, what do you see as kind of the opportunity for local media, because it's direly needed, right? I mean, if they're picking up AP stories, well, that's just stuff from other areas. You know, people need to know what's happening in their school boards and their city councils, library boards, and that stuff's not getting out at all anymore, from my perspective.
Right. I mean, you have groups like the Daily Line, and so you do have some hyper local neighborhood based reporting that is sprouting up, and providing some of that really important coverage. I don't know how long lasting that's going to be. We saw with like DNA Info that it was, you know, they tried to make a go of it and it just wouldn't work. So I'm not really sure. I think there is an opportunity for more WirePoints type organizations, and that's a good thing. You know, the media needs to have some pushback and some, someone holding them accountable as well. I mean, when I first joined the Tribune, so just to back up a little bit, I think journalism also is unique compared to other professions, where when reporters go, they sort of take all of their little, they take their knowledge and their passion with them. It's not like filling a doctor or a nurse or a teacher or, you know, somewhere you just kind of plug in and take up where that person left. I think about two reporters at the Tribune who left, who did that whole Broken Bonds series, where they really dug into city finances and explained, you know, this dangerous path that the city was on, and then they did a separate series on CPS. And I mean, we basically learned that we had just borrowed massive, massive amounts of money in a really high risk way to rebuild schools that were half empty. And we learned what kind of scoop and toss meant and why it was so problematic. Well, they both left the Tribune and all of that reporting kind of went out the door with them. So that's another problem with journalism is just you have people who build up this expertise and you can't really replace it. And I think that's maybe also a little unique to this profession.
You're absolutely right. You know, we've talked to reporters a lot, and you know, the ones that have the history of how things changed over the last 20 or 30 years and can remember the inflection points or what certain officials said and whether that came true or not, or whether they actually did the work or not. It's fascinating when you meet those people. And then, yeah, you meet other, you know, young, maybe they're very diligent and great reporters, but they just don't have that history. So, you know, there's no way that they can assume or, you know, I guess calculate what's happening in real time. They can just try to report on it, but it's weaker.
Kristen, don't you think that ultimately it has to be supported by philanthropy? Advertising revenue just isn't sufficient. You've had a firsthand look at the Tribune, which is in, you know, probably better shape than struggling as it was, better shape than some of the pure local papers. But, you know, you got philanthropic support behind Capital News, Illinois, Center Square, both of which we think do a good job. That's got to be part of the financial solution, don't you think?
I do. And I think you're seeing that in these discussions, for example, of the Sun-Times and WBEZ possibly merging. So I worked at WBEZ just for a short period before I went to the Tribune. I loved it. It was a great experience. But I was funded by the Joyce Foundation. I mean, my position was paid by the Joyce Foundation. And I was working as a State House reporter for WBEZ. And they were sharing me with the Chicago News Cooperative, which is another one of these sort of upstart organizations that we published print once or twice a week, I think it was, in the New York Times. So I was shared between these two institutions and funded by an outside group. It was a unique way, and I do think you will see more of that. What concerns me about that is, now I was never told what to cover. I was never pressured by the Joyce Foundation. They were just lovely people. They just wanted more, you know, they valued State House news coverage. But these organizations don't have to say who their donors are. And so, you know, when you do listen to an NPR story on Facebook, for example, you will often hear the anchor say, they'll disclose, Facebook is one of our, you know, funders to NPR. I mean, how often are we going to see local affiliates reveal that kind of information or say it? Or, you know, do we have confidence that there's not going to be some strings being pulled because you have the backing of organized labor at the Sun-Times, for example, or, you know, who knows how much Governor Pritzker and his various interests support WBEZ and some of these other entities. And so I think it raises questions just about funding and influences that we won't be able to know.
No question. And many of those who are supporting it philanthropically lean left. I mean, the large majority of them, MacArthur Foundation, look through the list of who they've given to, Ford Foundation. We've pursued some of those grants and, you know, they give us a polite response basically, but they're never going to fund us, many of those organizations. You know, you mentioned also sort of criticisms of the press. We have found many of them to be very thin-skinned. We don't have any criticism of the press. You know, at the national level, of course, they go after each other and like cats and dogs. But boy, if you challenge most of the local reporters here, you know, you're likely to get blocked on Twitter, called a racist or something else. It's not everybody. I mean, I took a few shots at you sometimes, Kristen. You know, you stood up for yourself and stood up for your team, and you're a big girl. I'm a big boy. I don't think it bothered us, but that's not always the case. I mean, couldn't we use a little more introspection in the local journalism and self-criticism?
Sure. Yes. I don't know that I mean, I've been called thin-skinned. So I think the issue, again, with the introduction of social media is, you know, criticism is fine, but we just get piled on in ways that are just so out of bounds by anonymous people. I mean, there's a very popular blog in Springfield that I'm sure we both know of, where commenters are still allowed to be anonymous. And so you can just have things said about you that are untrue by people who don't have to put their name next to what they're doing and saying. And Twitter, I mean, I hardly use it anymore for that reason. It's just, you know, when I was reporting and when I had an account, my name is next to everything that I said and did and wrote, and I have to bear the responsibility of that. And so this just allowing people to have these anonymous Twitter accounts, and then also the media kind of giving them credibility. You know, there are a couple Twitter accounts that reporters engage back and forth with these people, you know, routinely, and kind of consider these little, you know, empty circles to be credible. It's a little surprising to me. And so that's a long way of saying maybe that contributes to people being thin-skinned in media, because it's very tiresome to have to wake up to, you know, getting slammed 24/7, either in your inbox or on social media.
Yeah, right about the same time, local papers here, online papers, all cut out their comment sections, Tribune, Cranes, Sun-Times. What was behind that? I know you get a lot of nasty people there, but was that all there was to it, or was it pressure? You'd take some time to monitor those things and everything, but why did they all do it at the same time?
You know, that's a good question. My recollection at the Tribune was along the lines of what you're saying. It was too hard to police. So they initially just let anybody comment. And then I think they tried to link it to Facebook, where you had to at least have a Facebook account if you wanted to comment. And then they just stopped it altogether. I think legally it was probably becoming a problem. And yes, the amount of time taken to monitor that was just too much.
Yeah, and I think for some places it becomes a liability with the kind of things that are said on websites. And you know, if you leave them up, then are you you know, supporting those comments or not? So a lot of people have done that. I mean, we've been lucky, Mark, at WirePoints. I think we've had great commenters, very smart. Somehow we're lucky that there's not too many trolls that come on. So we're fortunate with that. So Kristen, with this, you know, I struggle with you know, I've got four kids. I've got a wife. And you know, I work at WirePoints, and you know, we by definition try to look at both sides, because one we aggregate, you know, we'll aggregate Sun-Times pieces and other sides from the other side on our site, and then of course conservative pieces as well, and so we're used to seeing all angles and arguing them, yeah. But my wife, for example, she reads the Tribune every day in the morning. She has her breakfast and reads the Tribune. She'll watch the local news. And then for the most part, she'll see some stuff on Facebook. And so she very often will not even see things that we're talking about, you know, at WirePoints or other groups similar to ours, which is just fascinating for me. So she wouldn't even understand the issue, if there is an issue, because it doesn't come up. So what do you see things going in the future? How does this start to get resolved? How do people get both sides again? And is it Substack and places like that? Are people going to have to just kind of pull together things themselves, or God knows?
I think a lot of it is on the consumers now. If you want to be informed, you have to go seek out the coverage that you trust. And with traditional media, I mean, there are still great reporting still happening. I mean, you can point to in the past month, great work being done at the Sun-Times and the Tribune and WBEZ. WBEZ has really beefed up its political reporting. They have some of the best education reporters in the city. So it's still there. I just think it really requires kind of a culture shift, and editors standing up to, maybe some of these younger and less experienced reporters, and making sure that front page every day is balanced, and that you have columns every single day that are balanced. And even when I was at the editorial page, another complaint I got all the time was on our columnist lineup. There were a couple, when I was writing a column, it was more conservative leaning. Of course, we had John Cass, but then every other local columnist was more liberal leaning. And when Trump was elected, it just turned everyone into like a new person. And so you would just see political stuff being dropped much more frequently in sports columns and in feature columns and arts columns. And all of that coverage just sort of got tainted with politics. And so in those cases, I really just think you need a strong editor who is going to, recognize the value of multiple viewpoints. It's really easy to take conservatives, and you know, our governor is great at this, to take an opposing viewpoint and just call it, you know, carnival barkers. That's one of his favorite terms. I'm sure it was referencing the editorial page more than once. That's what they do, but editors should be able to see through that and understand that there is great value in balance in the newspaper.
And boy, they sure don't do that. I mean, since you and John Cass left, there are no conservative right of center columnists in Illinois, I would argue, with the possible exception, I think, of the News Gazette, Jim Dye down there, and they're by no means far right. I think they're centrist, really. And boy, with Pritzker, that's one of our big complaints as reporters down there. Do not question him as toughly as they should. It's different in Chicago. I think they go after Lori Lightfoot, pretty diligently. But we get this constantly, the complaints from our readers too, that the press conferences are a waste of time. In the rare circumstances where they ask a good question, Pritzker gives a not answer and they move on. And so it's never followed up. And he basically has a free ride going down there. Am I overstating it, do you think? Or
I would say that something that has also changed a lot because of COVID, the accessibility of public officials. And so normally you would have a governor. I mean, when I was covering Edgar or Ryan or Blagojevich or Pat Quinn, I mean, they would stand at a podium and take questions and follow-up questions. And because of COVID, there were just, and it lasted far too long in terms of accessibility. They had, a pool reporter basically asking questions in a room, and then there's no real chance to follow up because you're sending a question on paper to someone who's just reading it. So, I mean, I do think the governor got, he got, I don't want to say a free ride, but he didn't experience for a very long time what governors and other public officials do with the press. I hope that will start to change. I think it should start to change. Because I would agree with you, I don't think he has experienced the type of questioning that is deserving of, the dramatic things that he is doing in Springfield and not doing.
Hey, Kristen, there's been so many crazy things going on this past 2 years. And I'm just curious from your vantage point where you had the power to decide what to cover on the editorial page. What drives you the most crazy about coverage these days? Because you've got COVID, you've got the handling of the finances of COVID, you've got the takeout of Trump, and you got the Biden administration, all the things that are going on. You got the CRT, all these things. What do you think is getting the coverage, or is it And that might not be an easy question because it might be all of the above. But from your perspective, what is being maligned the most, and probably more at the national level than the local level?
I think I would say just generally kind of a failure to connect dots. And I mean, you both know that financial reporting is just, that was my wheelhouse. That's what I wrote about a lot. And the reason I wrote about it a lot isn't because I love numbers. It's because, budgets to me are kind of moral documents. And so when there is a shortage or something needs more funding, or people are complaining about You know, there were stories of social service agencies kind of drying up during COVID, and the connection isn't made, or property taxes being too high, and they're not making the connection to unsustainable pensions. That's the kind of stuff that drives me crazy. And it really hit home for me when I think I was working for WBEZ at the time, and I was in the state house. This would have been like 2010, 2011. And, you know, the state always broke, can never meet spending with revenue because they spend too much. And they were closing one of the homes for the developmentally disabled. I think it was in Jacksonville. And I was watching, you know, it's May 29th, and you know how crazy it is in Springfield. And I'm watching these parents push their adult disabled kids around the Capitol, trying to get someone to listen to them, because now these elderly parents are going to be trying to either care for their kids at home, or they're going to put them in CILAs. And I just realized just how broken everything was. You know, this is so wrong. Government is supposed to take care of the most vulnerable. And so digging into that issue and then learning that, as you are well aware, there are people who have disabled kids who age out before they are even able to get care for their kids because there's no resources for that. Nobody cares, I guess. And so that's where my emphasis on financial reporting comes from, is just the how it trickles down and harms the people who need government the most. So in terms of what drives me crazy, it's the failure to connect those dots and to think that, you know, when we were writing, which I think was, they were really outstanding editorials, both from John McCormick, who was my predecessor, and then we picked up the ball and kind of did a series against the Fair Tax Amendment. You know, that's not because we're stingy people trying to be a voice for billionaires in the state. It's because we're fed up. And I think that showed in voters. We're fed up just sending blank checks to Springfield and still having to deal with this problem of the most vulnerable not getting the care and the attention that they deserve. That's a long answer, but the lack of connecting dots, I think, is what drives me crazy.
Boy, that example, Kristen, too, of the lack of funding for the developmentally disabled is the perfect one, too, because Illinois really stinks at that. And even as a fiscal conservative, that's an area where I'd love to see more attention devoted by the media and try to find some way to fix it. I think we have some 23,000 people on a waiting list who are developmentally disabled who qualify, but they're just not getting the service they deserve because we're so far behind in that area. We should be tackling that, Ted, at Wire Points, and taking a harder look at some point on that.
Yeah, Kristen, you brought up, you know, it's always the little guy that gets hurt, it seems like, in Illinois, because somehow the political equations always leave them out. And I was in Decatur last week. I spent a day and a half there, and I particularly went to go see the education results and understand why they are so bad in Decatur in the public schools. And when I was there, it was much more than just the depressing school results. I mean, if you look at the Black and Hispanic reading results and math results for a third grader, they are abysmal. It's hard to find worse in the state. And yet, while I was there, you know, I looked at how much struggle there is, as we all know, from the manufacturing, the decline of that city. It's had a lot of inflection points that have turned that state and city and continue to worsen it. And I feel like, to your point, nobody's been able to connect those dots between, you know, these massive deficits we have for what we spend on the public sector, for this massive, the most units of government in the country, some of the biggest pensions. We've run the numbers at Wire Points. These pensions are massive on average compared to other states like Indiana or Florida. And yet somehow we can't connect the dots that all those bad policies are destructive for the low income, for the low earners, forget what color they are. Just, you know, even the results of the Decatur public schools for the whites are abysmal. So I guess the question is going to be, you know, what do we need to do? You know, again, with media, is it going to be because it's a digital platform that brings all this stuff to life? How do we win this battle to inform people and help them connect the dots?
I mean, continuing to tell human stories. I've said this before, but I had a mayor from the suburbs approach me after a City Club event. I think the City Club event was on pensions. You were probably on the panel. You were probably there. So many of those. Those were helpful, though, in you know, just informing people as to what the problem is. But anyway, this mayor approached me and he said, you know, the reporting, for example, on pensions, it's always focused on that big number of unfunded pension liability. He said, nobody gets that. It doesn't really, you know, it's not really important to keep focusing on the numbers. He said, start writing stories about the 50-year-old police chief who retires and how much his pension is, and then where he goes next and how much that pension is. And you've done a lot of that reporting and it's been done, but not to the drumbeat that I think it could. And so telling those stories, you, or maybe it was the Policy Institute years ago, followed a student from her home on several buses and how long it took her to get to school because she wanted
2 hours or something.
Right. So that was a great school choice, you know, bringing it home kind of example. The more we can tell those kinds of stories and connect the dots. I was at the getting my license plate sticker recently. And of course, I think this was 2020 maybe when the price shot up. And everyone in the room behind me was also complaining. Why is this going up? It's going up. And I said to the whole room, this was in the budget that was passed last year in Springfield by Democrats and the governor, because this is how they manage your finances. So pay attention. I think everybody thought I was a little crazy, but really.
One quick challenge, and it's not a challenge because I totally agree with what you're saying, but I want to hear your story. We're going to write about Decatur and you know, there's 8,400 kids. And, you know, I forget what the number is right now, but it, you know, might be that only 10% can read at grade level across the entire school. So let's just say that there's 8,000 kids. I always worry that if I tell one story, it's anecdotal, when damn it, there's 8,000 kids who are getting out of that school who can't read. And so for me, I always struggle because the 8,000 is the big number. I don't want to bring it down to one. And I'm not suggesting that you're saying that, because we're telling the story so that we can say, hey, that story is happening to 8,000 people. But I always worry that in a lot of the storytelling that goes on both the left and the right now, the bigger numbers, the 8,000, gets lost because people focus on the one and then wonder whether that story is true or not. So what's your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think you're right that, you know, you can take one story and it turns into an anecdote and not real life. But I mean, good reporting, as you know, is a mix. You tell someone's story and you back it up with actual data. So I just think with pensions, you know, everyone's still getting paid and budgets are still getting passed. And there's just not this connection between like property taxes. And to your point on Decatur, you know, I covered the south suburbs of Chicago for a very long time. And there is a lack of understanding of how policies connect to just the complete abandonment of some of those towns. And one example, which did get written about, but again, not enough, not with consistency, was something that the Cook County Board passed. You guys probably wrote about it. And I might be not remembering this correctly, but it had something to do with hiring, making sure that you were, for all these projects, you had to hire union labor. Yeah. And you had to have all these protections in contracts. And so it shoots up the cost of doing anything in these towns. And you had, I think, the mayor of Homewood step up and say, this is exactly why we have such high property taxes and we've had such businesses fleeing, is because the Democrats who are in the pockets of the unions who are controlling the Cook County Board are passing bad policy. And thing, you know, we editorialized about it again. It needs the drumbeat. It needs to be on the front page. It needs to be written about a lot so that there's enough pressure on those public officials to rescind that policy. They still haven't done it.
Of course, Kristen, where did you learn to write? I asked because you were always, I thought, the best opinion writer in the state. No offense, John Cass, if you're listening, we love you for different reasons. But just in terms of how you wrote your articles, where did you learn that?
Gosh, I just good editors probably over the years. I think I probably started out being more flowery in my writing. And I can remember, so when I started writing more hard-hitting opinion columns, that was at the Tribune. And I can remember turning in editorials in particular, to Bruce Dold, who was the editorial page editor at the time. And he would take what I sent him, but kind of tear it up, put a new lead on. And I finally walked into his office one day upset. And I said, what am I doing wrong? I was kind of new. I said, what am I doing wrong? And he said, oh, you're not doing anything wrong. I used to cover Springfield. This is my wheelhouse. I love it. So I put more of my stamp on what you turn in because of what you tend to cover. But he also taught me to just be frank. And so I'm sure there are many people who disagree with the way that I write, but I tried to just have like a cadence to my writing that was not flowery, very, you know, data driven. If I'm going to take a stand on something, I'm going to refer to documents or campaign finance reports or something. And just, you know, not hold back.
You said the word frank. Okay. So give us some frank feedback about wire points. seriously, tell us, we have thick skins here. What could we be doing better? How are we doing? Any thoughts on where we should focus further attention?
Well, I mean, I think the reporting that you do is so valuable, but kind of hidden on your site. I would rearrange your website so that when you are doing your own wire points reporting, it's easier to find. And I would try to just build more relationships with news media. Maybe you feel like you've tried to do that and failed, but you know, you should be in. We ran a great series that you co-wrote, or maybe it was more Ted, on pension solutions. Those kinds of things should be in the paper on a routine basis. But I trust what you do. I know you get pushback. I've seen it, but I think the pushback you get is more because of the topics that you cover, because you're more conservative leaning, and not because of the inaccuracy of what you're saying. No one is ever pointing to something that Ted Dabrowski writes and says, this is incorrect. They just don't like it because it's a contrarian voice to what is commonly, you know, accepted and not challenged in the state. So other than just doing more to get your own original content out there,
I have a quick question on repetition. We always wonder, you know, you talked about the drumbeat, and I totally agree with that. You know, these kind of things, you can't write about them 1 month and then come back to them 6 months later. It's just, you know, it falls out of people's minds. But at the same time, it's hard to be repetitive. Is it okay to be repetitive? Do you think it hurts, or it's just part of the game that we have to do? Or is drumbeat mean the same issue, but you have to do it lots of different ways?
I think you have to do it lots of different ways. And that's such a good question, because I struggled with that a lot on the editorial board, and especially when I was the page editor, where, you know, how many times can we write about pensions? Mm-hmm. And so Bruce Dold and John McCormick, they had a joke about it. They said, you know, 1,000 editorials before something actually moves the needle. So I did keep that in mind, but yes, you get into a trick bag of being predictable. And I think we did that on the editorial page, where it was like, oh gee, here's another rant about pensions. And so even people who cared about it just moved past it. So one thing that I tried to do when we did the series leading up to the vote on the fair tax was stop talking to our readers. They get it. They know it. They've seen it. Mm-hmm. They understand it. And so I kind of made a list, you know, if we want this fair tax to go down, we have to appeal to union members. We have to appeal to Democrats. We have to appeal to CTU members. And so in every editorial, and in a couple that were just standalones, that's who we spoke to. So, you know, trying to get around your audience, who is who you rely on to reach those other groups is really important, especially if you're going to, you know, pound away at something for years like we did. And there's still no pension reform. So,
Kristen, you've had some time to reflect on Illinois, hopefully with a couple of months off after you left the Tribune. You wrote for years about some of those problems that have gone unaddressed, continue to gradually destroy the state. Give us your big picture thoughts. Do you have any sense of optimism, or the political winds seem to be shifting across the country? Is that going to make a difference, or where are we going to go from here, do you think?
You know, I do think there are a couple, you know, winds shifting type arguments you could make. I think the crime in Chicago has really engaged a lot of people in their own voting behavior in a way that maybe has not happened before. The exodus of kids from CPS and a lot of those parents who also just sort of like gave up because of some of the things that union leadership does. And maybe there was a recognition finally that, you know, they're watching all these other kids go to school and their kids are staying home and the constant fighting and roadblocks thrown up by CTU. I think there's a little bit of maybe a chance for maybe some school choice momentum here. So, I mean, no, I haven't given up. It is just really nice to watch it from the from here. And I don't miss the grind of a daily newspaper and the pressure and the pushback. I don't miss it at all. But I still love Illinois and all of the writing that we did on Illinois and writing about the census numbers and Illinois exodus and all of that comes from a place of wanting to shake the shoulders of politicians and get them to change direction. So, yeah, I have hope. I live in the city. We like where we live. We don't have any plans to leave. But I do think there are a couple little windows of opportunity that maybe some contrarian voices can take advantage of.
Well, Ted, if you don't have anything else, we'll let Kristen get back to her new job. We sure appreciate it, Kristen, if you ever have anything that you feel like writing about or talking about, we're always happy to hear it. Best of luck to you and congratulations on all the fine work that you did while you're at the Tribune, and all the best to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.